Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. This episode about the RPAR Risk Parity ETF is a great example of collaboration between you, the listener, and myself. One of you reached out to me on Twitter. You can follow me there at Giant ETF Fisher, that's with a PH, and asked that we do an episode on this ETF. And I was only too happy to oblige, considering how successful it's been out of the gate since it launched in December. If you have a specific topic or fund that you'd like covered on this show, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter or directly at jonathan@seekingalpha.com, and I'd be happy to see what I can do to make it happen. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the afternoon of Tuesday, June 23rd, 2020. My guests today are Alex Shahidi and Damien Bisserier of Advanced Research Investment Solutions, or ARIS. Alex and Damien oversee the research and client service efforts at ARIS, including managing the portfolio underlying the RPAR Risk Parity ETF, ticker symbol RPAR. Prior to launching ARIS in 2014, Alex worked as an institutional consultant at Merrill Lynch, where he led one of the firm's largest institutional consulting groups, advising more than $10 billion in assets. He is a CFA, a CIMA, a CFP, a CLU, and a CHFC. Barron's Magazine ranked him one of America's top 100 independent financial advisors in 2016 through 2018. His book titled Balanced Asset Allocation, How to Profit in Any Economic Climate was released in late 2014. He earned both his undergraduate and law degrees at the University of California. Prior to launching ARIS, Damien spent nearly a decade as a senior client advisor and senior investment associate at Bridgewater Associates, where he saw firsthand how Ray Dalio managed the all-weather portfolio, which later became the basis of RPAR. In that role, Damien was responsible for managing relationships across more than 50 North American institutional clients, including endowments, foundations, pension plans, and family offices, ranging in size from $1 billion to $100 billion. He is a graduate of Princeton. Anyway, welcome to the show, guys. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, so before we jump into the topic at hand, which is this just really unique ETF that you launched really fairly recently, just in December of 2019, that's really just shot out of the gate in terms of the assets that it's gathered. And, you know, obviously the current market climate and environment are going to be a big part of that. But I do think that you were gaining momentum really before COVID kind of entered center stage here. But before that, I just wanted to congratulate you guys on winning the 2019 ETF.com award in the alternatives category. And just curious what that was like, that feeling of being recognized for the work that you've done.
That was exciting and unexpected. This is our first ETF that we've launched, so we weren't even aware that such awards existed. So it was a nice way to find out.
Totally. Yeah. They're kind of a big deal in the ETF space, but yeah, I wouldn't say they're quite on the level of like the Oscars or something like that in terms of name recognition.
It felt like winning an Oscar though.
Did you get to give an acceptance speech at least?
Not yet. We're waiting for the call.
Nice. All right. So anyway, the asset flows into RPAR, your fund, have really been nothing short of astounding. Just for people that want to know, the full name of the fund is the RPAR Risk Parity ETF, and the ticker symbol is RPAR. And so you're basically at $500 million already, roughly 7 months after launching, which is really quite a good launch. With everything going on in global markets right now, is obviously a strategy that's resonated with both institutional and retail investors. So let's just start from the beginning here. If you could explain to listeners what the strategy underlying the fund is, that'd be great.
Sure. Obviously, it's easy to grow quickly when you're doing relatively well. You know, so the performance has worked out thus far, up about 6%, you know, in the first 6 months. And obviously through a global pandemic, which no one expected when this was launched. So the strategy overall is to invest across a diverse set of asset classes that are biased to perform well in different economic environments. And the way to think about this is, you know, we know that equities will do well when the economy is doing well, and we know they'll do poorly when the economy is doing poorly. Without having to guess what is going to happen next, there's a reliable connection between the economic environment and the performance of equities. The same thing can be said of asset classes like treasuries. They basically have the opposite bias in terms of economic growth. If the economy weakens, we know the treasuries will do well and equities will do poorly. And so we take a set of asset classes that have these diverse characteristics and put them together to build a balanced allocation.
Sure. Although, of course, we'll get into, the strategy goes well beyond just equities and fixed income positions. So just out of curiosity, what's the history of this type of strategy's performance?
Well, the ETF was launched in mid-December of last year, and it's earned a little more than 6% in a little over 6 months as of today. And so it's you know, done relatively well despite the environment that we've lived through. But the track record, you can think of it, could be much longer than that, because we're effectively investing in indexes across these diverse asset classes. And those indexes have long histories. And I think what's interesting is if you look at some of these markets going back 50 years or so, the return of global equities is not that different from the return of assets like gold, which we own. Even long-term treasuries, the 50-year return is comparable to equities. I think that would surprise a lot of people. And these three areas are actually, for the most part, uncorrelated to equities. So if you can put together several diverse asset classes like gold, TIPS, inflation-protected bonds, treasuries, and even commodities, they have comparable returns to equities over the long period, and they're not very correlated. And when you put them together and you rebalance regularly, that's how you can achieve an equity-like return with a lot less risk.
And this strategy seems fairly similar to the all-weather portfolio popularized by Ray Dalio. So just curious what the specific differences are. I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with the all-weather portfolio.
I'm going to let Damien handle that since he worked there for about a decade.
Yeah.
Well, the conceptual framework underlying all weather and RPAR is very similar. We've obviously been very influenced by those principles. You know, I having worked there and Alex, actually the book that he wrote was based on those principles as well. And so I'd say that this is a much simpler implementation. We are more mindful of being tax efficient in this structure. You know, so ETFs, as you know, by their nature are much more tax efficient structures than private funds, where all weather is implemented. This one is daily liquid. It's available to everyone. So people always ask me, what's the minimum investment size for RPAR? I tell them $20, because that's the share price, which is a much more accessible than $100 million. So, and then just in our design, you know, we utilize less leverage than all weather does. We can talk specifically about the construction, but the mix, when you look at it, it looks quite a bit different. But again, the conceptual framework is very similar.
Right. Okay. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. But I guess before we get into additional specifics there, so you guys mentioned on your site, and I mean, this is kind of a common comparison that's often made between things like all weather portfolio, permanent portfolio, to a traditional 60-40 stock bond allocation. So I think it will surprise many investors that a 60-40 stock bond allocation actually has roughly 85% of its portfolio risk loaded into the 60% that's stocks. So when you describe your fund as being a true risk parity strategy, how is that achieved exactly in terms of the breakdowns of different asset classes? And what mechanisms do you have if things, let's say, move very rapidly as they did from February 19th to March 23rd of this year to get the risk profile back into order as quickly as possible?
Okay, lot there. So the idea is balance across asset classes. And the real focus of the strategy is to not just target risk balance by asset, but also target risk balance by environment. Really, we think of the world in terms of the environment is constantly shifting. And you want a portion of the portfolio to be biased to do well during whatever environment transpires. And so thinking from that framework, we use four major asset classes. Equities, commodities, which includes gold, TIPS, these are inflation protected bonds, and treasuries. So equities, commodities, TIPS, and treasuries. Those are the four major asset classes. And those are selected because each of them is biased to do well in different environments. And we think of environments in terms of growth and inflation. So there are periods when growth is what is driving markets. And you saw that in the 80s and 90s. And then there's periods when inflation is driving markets. You saw that in the 70s. And so each of these is biased to do well in those various economic environments. And so we risk balance across these asset classes so that the total portfolio is not overly influenced by any single asset class. Unlike 60-40, as you mentioned, which is effectively dominated by how equities perform. When equities are doing well, 60-40 does well. And when equities are doing poorly, 60-40 does poorly. We don't want that bias within our part. And so the allocation, there's a long-term target to these four asset classes. And that target is 25% global equities, 25% commodities, 35% long-term treasuries, and 35% long-term TIPS. And you'll notice that TIPS and treasuries have a higher allocation than commodities and equities. And it's because those two are less volatile. And so a greater allocation to those effectively balances the portfolio from a risk perspective so that each of them provides an equal contribution to the total return. Now that's the long-term target return. When we launched the ETF, that's what the allocation was. Now there is a trigger we have in place because again, the goal is to maintain balance to different economic environments. The trigger that is in the strategy is when the deflation alarms start to sound, and we define that as when interest rates fall to extremely low levels like they did in March, there is this small shift in the target allocation, which is temporary until we go back into a more normal environment. And that small shift is to reduce TIPS and increase treasuries and gold. And specifically, it's reduce TIPS by 15%, increase treasuries and gold by 7.5% each. And we do that because we think that combination provides comparable inflation hedging components, but it has much more robust deflation hedging aspects to it. And when the risk of deflation is greater, like we're experiencing today, we think that that's warranted to maintain balance. So that's the overall allocation. We rebalance regularly once a quarter, automatically without concern about what's happening in the markets, which has actually helped us so far this year. And because that rebalancing happens regularly once a quarter, the question you asked earlier in terms of how do you maintain that balance through extreme environments like we saw in March, because we rebalance regularly, the allocations never veer too far off those targets. So even at the end of March, when markets were going haywire, equities sold off significantly, as everybody knows. Treasuries, for example, actually went the other way. They rallied. But even at that extreme point, we were still within 3% of those target allocations that I described earlier. So there's no need to rebalance even more frequently than quarterly.
Gotcha. But so, I mean, this fund kind of attempts to hew to the Advanced Research Risk Parity Index, right? But it's not quite an index fund, is it? Can you explain why it's not exactly an index fund if you're not, for example, allowed to jump in and make some tweaks mid-quarter?
Sure. So it's I call it mostly an index fund because its mandate, the ETF's mandate, is to track that risk parity index as closely as it can. It has a little bit of flexibility in that we can decide which ETFs to purchase to gain that exposure that we're trying to achieve. There's a little bit of tax management that's involved to try to minimize capital gains distributions. But for the most part, its objective is to very closely track that index, which is obviously passive.
Right. Okay. No, that makes a lot of sense. And definitely in terms of the tax management side of things, something where you're rebalancing quarterly, if this were not inside of an ETF wrapper, you weren't able to do those in-kind transactions, I imagine you would be a lot more likely to stick investors with some kind of taxable gain at the end of the year.
That's right. Yeah. And there's also tax loss harvesting within the ETF. Mm-hmm. So in periods like March and April, there are some opportunities to take advantage of that as well.
Definitely. So in terms of just how far you can go on the bands here, because you said something about how, for example, in the current environment, I'm assuming you're still underweight TIPS right now, correct?
Oh, yeah, yes. Compared to those long-term target allocation, that's correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's just say, and there was a period fairly recently where markets were actually predicting negative rates, which I guess considering what's happening at the Fed right now and the Treasury and considering the road that's kind of been paved by countries like Japan and Germany, seems like not an impossibility anymore in the U.S. I mean, how far can you veer from those allocations?
Well, the allocations are set to provide the guide to what we want the portfolio to look like over time. And so if you get if rates go negative, then you'll probably get a significant rally in things like treasuries and TIPS, and then they would be sold at the end of that quarterly period and just rebalanced again. So we're just trying to build that balance with that target allocation.
Yeah, I think maybe there's a clarification needed though. So the index itself shifted when interest rates got very low in March. So we are still tracking the index with the ETF. The index itself changed to have that lower weight to TIPS. That wasn't a deviation that we took relative to the index. That was a systematic change that was made in the index to deal with a low rate environment. And there could be theoretically, let's say you get into an environment where rates go negative and bonds no longer perform the way they have historically in a downside growth scenario. It could warrant additional changes down the road. We don't think we're near that point yet, but certainly things could evolve. So, we will continue to evaluate the index and make sure that we're achieving that risk balance across economic drivers, because we think that's the critical aspect of how we achieve diversification. That's where a lot of, I think, risk parity strategies are not as successful, because they think of risk parity as parity across assets. And so a good example is a lot of risk parity strategies have a similar risk allocation to stocks and credit. And the problem is that stocks and credit are actually quite similar. So, and you saw that in March, in February and March. So as you get these downside growth surprises, equities and credit actually trade with a very high correlation to one another, and they go down a lot. And so you're not getting that natural offset that we would get if you had exposures that are reliably different and perform reliably differently in different environments. And so we really think that's an important aspect of managing a risk parity strategy, is thinking through balanced economic drivers. And the index is designed in order to ensure that we always have that balance.
Yeah, the one thing I would add to that is there's this concern that when there's a crisis, correlations go to one. And you've heard that before. There's been articles written about that notion of diversification doesn't really work when you really need it, because when there's a crisis, correlations go to one and assets trade together. Now, what's interesting is I think that's true for a lot of what's typically found in portfolios. But when you look at the assets that are truly diverse, like treasuries, gold, for example, the correlation often goes to negative one during a crisis. And you saw that this year, where treasuries are up over 20% year to date, gold is up over 15%. And then you saw the same thing in 2008. Treasuries and gold did really well during that time when most other things sold off. And so that goes to the point of selecting which asset classes to include, even within a risk parity, within the comparable risk parity framework, is critical. And that really comes through during those significant downturns.
Right, absolutely. In terms of those correlations, so you do end up with some duration risk on the treasuries, though, right? Does the strategy or does the index ever shorten up the duration, or it's always longer term treasuries that it holds?
It's always longer term by design. And the reason is because you don't know when the next downturn is coming. 2020 is a perfect example of that. In December, nobody expected a global pandemic and unemployment rates to quadruple, right? That was not in anyone's expectations. And so if you're trying to time when you think the next downturn is going to come, and so maybe you go shorter duration when you don't think it's coming and you go longer duration when you do think it's coming, you're probably going to be wrong half the time, if not more. And so we always hold that, because that's what provides the hedge when those unexpected downturns occur. And 2020 is a prime example of that. 2008 as well.
Definitely. It's a good point. You really don't have any vision into what's going to happen even a few weeks forward, as this entire COVID-19 situation has proven. And so to start trying to kind of chase potential trends or directions of the market could be really fraught with risk, and you just kind of always end up on the wrong side of
that. Yeah, and I'd say any time, if you think about any time in our lifetimes, that looking ahead, the potential range of economic outcomes is wider than any of us have ever seen. You could have a Japan-type scenario where there's entrenched deflation. You could have inflation. You could even have hyperinflation with the amount of money printing that's going on. The Fed is trying to create inflation. They may actually get their way. And anything in between. And if you think about most portfolios, they're not positioned for most potential outcomes. They're positioned for one or two. And so having these components in place all the time is a critical aspect to achieving true balance.
On the point about long-term bonds, I want to revisit something I alluded to earlier, which is this notion of leverage in the portfolio. So you're correct that we primarily use longer dated bonds, and because longer dated bonds are much more volatile than short-term bonds, we don't have as much need for leverage in this portfolio. So that's another, I think, big differentiator in terms of how we implement this portfolio versus many other risk parity strategies. We use much less leverage. So the portfolio is levered about 20%. So for every dollar you put in, you have about $1.20 of exposure. That's much less than any other risk parity strategy I can think of. And that's also helpful in periods like March, when many strategies that are much more levered are actively delevering and having to manage that much more tightly. Because we don't have that degree of leverage, we don't have the same need for delevering. We actually designed the strategy to target longer term volatilities. And so we're not nearly as active. And that actually benefited the strategy in March, because many, many risk parity strategies were forced to cut their risk, delever, because they're trying to target a short term volatility measure. We did not do that. And we had a much bigger snapback in terms of performance. And that's resulted, I think, in very competitive returns relative to a peer group. Because we had that snapback to a much greater degree than others that were forced to cut their leverage and risk at the worst possible time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And again, if you're targeting longer term volatility, you're not holding any corporate credit. So there's no credit risk here. It's just duration risk where, for example, if rates do really shoot higher, obviously that part of the portfolio is going to perform worse than if you were, let's say, you know, had some kind of a equally weighted ladder of treasuries going 1 to 30 years or something. But on the other hand, as you say, it eliminates the need for leverage. So, you know, these are just trade-offs that investors need to understand when they consider.
And the way we think about that is if you have a rising rate environment, so we're taking the opposite perspective, you have to consider what would cause rates to rise. So typically it's because the economy, it's either because the economy is doing well, in which case rates rise because there's an expectation that the Fed will effectively increase rates over time. And if the economy is doing well, that's going to be a positive environment for equities and commodities typically. And so the treasuries may underperform, but those other asset classes outperform. And the other reason rates may rise, like you saw in the 1970s, is inflation may take off. You know, rates went up to, you know, double digits during that period. And if that happened, then that's bad for treasuries, but it's good for inflation hedged assets like gold or commodities or TIPS. And so that's how that balancing mechanism works, where you don't have to guess which way rates are going to go, whether they're going to go down or they're going to go up. You have assets that do well in either environment, and as long as you're balancing across them, for the most part, you're indifferent to what happens.
Yeah, totally. So I guess just to kind of sharpen this up, relative to, let's say, a 60-40 stock bond mix, what would an expected standard deviation be on this portfolio?
We expect it to be comparable to 60-40, around, let's say, a 10% volatility long term. But we expect a return that's comparable to equities. So equity-like return with 60-40, you know, 10% volatility type risk. And then our expectation is the portfolio would be a lot more consistent than even 60-40 over time because it is more balanced than 60-40.
Right. So, I mean, I guess in terms of just people that maybe, you know, the kind of, to me at least, the ultimate sleep at night measure is what your potential max drawdown would be at any given time. How badly, theoretically, has a strategy like this performed at the, let's say, worst possible market environment where basically everything was going down in tandem? And I guess in any case, even if stocks and bonds were going down, I guess gold would probably be going up in that environment. But just out of curiosity, what kind of max drawdown could somebody expect with this?
Well, at the end of March, which was near the lows, the ETF was down 4% year to date. Now it was up a little bit before that. So I think the drawdown during that period was in the 15-20% range from peak to trough, and then it bounced back very quickly. And obviously now it's, you know, up over 5% year to date.
Right. So in other words, the drawdown was essentially half or slightly less even than things like the SPX or the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And now on the way up, it's obviously outperforming those year to date also.
That's correct.
Yeah. And so to Alex's point, having that diversified mix should help you mitigate that tail risk that's inherent in markets. And so you see that in those most extreme type of drawdown periods. You see the tails as, you know, you're still going to have some sensitivity to it. Obviously, you're holding assets, but you should be able to avoid the very severe drops like we saw in the stock market in that period.
Sure. I mean, and to me, those are just so important behaviorally, because the worse the tail risk gets or is actualized, the more likely someone is to do, you know, the worst possible thing that they can do and panic sell basically at the low or close to it. And now you don't only have those losses, you've actually locked them in at that point. So I do think that it's important to limit that, because you really did need, let's say, in that period from 07 where the markets peaked until March 2009, you needed an iron will not to unload some of your, let's say, longer term equity positions at least. And I remember telling my parents, I think in like December 08, because they were like, oh my God, things are going to keep on going lower, we better sell something. I remember telling them, don't do it, don't sell right now. And they did it anyway. They couldn't stop themselves from doing it. So it's it's good, you know, if you can prevent those kinds of really terrible scenarios, because usually investors compound them behaviorally with bad behavior after big sales.
Yeah, and then the other aspect to that, which is actually one of the reasons we created the ETF, is that within the ETF, the positions are relatively risky, right? So equities within the ETF are very volatile. Commodities are volatile. Even the treasuries and tips are volatile because they're longer duration. But the ETF from a package perspective, it has been relatively stable. So we have those volatile assets within it. And because investors can't sell what's inside, they can only sell the entire ETF, they're more likely to hold on to the total portfolio through those devastating periods, because the total portfolio is responding much more favorably than any single component within it. So that's another reason why packaging it all together benefits clients, because it prevents them or it makes it less likely that they will sell at the lows, as we know is very typical.
So I'd love to get into some of the specific holdings here. And again, you've discussed a little bit earlier how this is where the discretion comes in. I mean, there's obviously some tax managing going on also. But in terms of, do you buy, let's say, fund A or fund B or specific, we're going to get into specific holdings, just single stock holdings in there also in a bit. And just curious what the process is like, because I'm sure that listeners of this show will be very curious. Well, you know, you guys are doing this professionally. You've got $500 million in AUM here, and that number, if trends keep up, you'll be over $1 billion before the end of this year, I assume. And so how are you, for example, let's just go through a couple of the different ETF holdings here, starting with that gold holding, because this is one that is always a head scratcher for me. You see the AUM in a fund like GLD, which has charges 40 basis points. And then you see the AUM in a fund like BAR, the Granite Shares fund. And we've had Will Rind on this show a couple times, a great guy and great advocate for building lower cost products for investors. And there's the equivalent SGOL also, which is the same, just 17 basis point product. And I'm just curious why you guys have selected BAR over GLD. And then if you had any thoughts as to why those assets in GLD are as sticky as they are. I mean, maybe, I guess it's a little tighter, the bid ask, the spreads in terms of getting in and out of it. But I can't really imagine with how liquid even a fund like BAR is, that those extra 23 basis points are worthwhile to many firms. And yet you see that that's what they're loading
up.
Yeah,
it is a bit of a head scratcher for us as well. We view all of these ETFs as being very comparable. They track one another very closely. Because we're not trading actively, the spread is not as big of a deal. And even then, the spreads are extremely close. So we're, our goal is to get the exposure that we want as cheaply as possible. And so that's why we selected BAR. We also have GLDM in the portfolio as well. And those two are very comparable in price, but GLD is way too expensive for us to hold, because all those costs get passed through to the underlying investors, and we're trying to minimize the cost. We have a 50 basis points expense ratio, and that includes the underlying fund expenses. And so our incentive is to keep those fund expenses as low as possible.
Yeah, sure. And I'm sure investors appreciate that. Why would they want to pay an extra 10 or 15 basis points when they're getting literally the same exposure, just gold in a vault being guarded by somebody somewhere? Sure. And then in terms of a lot of your equity exposures, so you're holding Vanguard ETFs like VTI, VWO, VEA. There are other firms out there that have funds that are competitively priced to Vanguard, firms like Schwab and Fidelity. So just curious why you went with Vanguard there. Is it the size and the liquidity, or what's the thought process?
Damon, do you want to cover that one?
Sure. Well, in that particular case, it's part of the index. So the index is actually made up of those specific ETFs. And you're right that there are a few different products. They're all very similar to one another. And so we will use those other products for loss harvesting purposes. but we're comfortable with the Vanguard exposure, you know, as it's low cost, it's very liquid. You know, these are very large funds, you know, well-established, obviously fund sponsor. And so that's the thought process there, is really just track the index as tightly as we can with very low cost index funds.
Yeah, sure. No, that makes a lot of sense also. And I guess, you know, 3 basis points on some of these, or maybe if on VTI, I guess on the foreign ones, it's a couple more, but really, you know, again, you can't really argue with paying that little for that kind of exposure. So I see that you're holding a bunch of individual energy producers like BHP, Exxon, Chevron, well, as well as industrial plays like Deere and materials producers like Rio Tinto and Vale. Why go with individual company risk here as opposed to low-cost index funds for these sectors?
So on the commodity exposure, we looked at the available ETFs out there, and we were looking for a commodity producer index. And there are a couple, which we've actually used in our client portfolios before, but they tend to be very expensive, you know, expense ratios in excess of 40 basis points. So we realized that we could create a more tailored exposure that was more explicitly what we wanted at a much lower cost by just creating this index ourselves. So part of our development efforts when we created the index was actually to design the commodity producer index component of the strategy. And so we track that index within the ETF with individual stocks. And specifically how we constructed the index is our primary motivation was to get as close to the underlying commodities as possible. So you may be familiar that a lot of the other risk parity strategies utilize commodity futures, and so they're getting more direct commodity exposure. We wanted to use commodity equities as opposed to commodity futures because the return profile is much higher. If you look historically, that equity risk premium has added significant return. And also we thought it would be much more tax efficient because with those futures, you tend to get income distributions, you know, in the mutual fund context, whereas here, we can get deferred long-term cap gains and you know, qualified dividend income. So we created this custom basket of commodity producers that was allocated 35% to energy producers, 35% to miners, ex-gold miners, because we wanted the gold exposure direct. So we're actually holding gold, as we talked about. So it's just the industrial metals miners that we're allocating to here. 20% to agricultural related stocks. So that's where the names like Deere come in. There aren't really farming stocks per se. You know, you have fertilizer companies and agricultural chemical companies and companies like Deere that are very much directly tied to the fortunes of farmers. So that's the 20% there, but it's a less tight fit than you'd see in energy or miners, for instance. And then we have 5% to water and 5% to clean energy. And I could envision over time that clean energy piece getting larger as, you know, as the world becomes less dependent on traditional fossil fuels.
So Contango, is that part of the equation there also, I would assume, in terms of like you look at a lot of these commodities funds and they really are climbing a steep hill over time because Contango is kind of the regular state of affairs with most commodities futures contracts. And so they're really just battling against, you know, that 3 or 4% headwind every single month as they roll the futures over. And there's, you know, strategies to try to manage that. But you look at the long-term returns and the indexes often don't match the price of the underlying commodities.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that was part of the research that led us to decide to utilize commodity producer equities as opposed to commodity futures.
Sure. But I mean, of course, in terms of the betas on these positions, you do still have equity risk there. So in terms of the diversification effect, that, you know, the statement, Alex, that you were referring to earlier, that all correlations rise to one in a panic or a crisis. So, you know, we know that's not true. Obviously, equities go down, gold goes up or treasuries go up, but you could see a scenario where, for example, oil was going up, but Exxon was going down anyway, or vice versa. So just curious how those betas come into play here.
So you're absolutely right that the commodity producer equities are going to be highly correlated with the broader stock market. So we think of that exposure actually as two exposures. We think of it as an exposure to the underlying commodities and then an exposure to equities. So you can adjust in terms of how you're thinking about the broader portfolio. You can make sure that you factor in the aspect of getting additional equity exposure as you get that commodity exposure. And so that can influence your overall allocation decision. And then what we do as well is we have a larger allocation to gold, which helps offset some of that equity risk. Gold is a great diversifier to the equity exposure within commodities. So when you add gold in size to the commodity producer equities, you actually get something that's much less correlated to equities than you might envision initially when you're thinking about commodity producer equities. But you're absolutely right that is a very high beta exposure there.
Sure. And I guess because I assume many of these positions are already in some of the ETFs that you're holding, things like Vexon and Chevron and Deer will be in a fund like VTI, and then fund like VWO, you know, maybe you'll have a Rio Tinto or a Vale in there, VEA, you'll have, you know, BHP in there. So are these essentially your largest equity positions or just based on the way that an index like VTI is cap weighted, or your top equity position still when you boil it down, things like Microsoft and Apple?
I mean, there's, when you add up, when you look through the underlying ETFs that we own and the individual commodity producer equities that we own, it adds up to about 13,000 stocks, which is cap weighted. So it's going to be, there is really no large allocation to anything, just because there's so many companies in there. But it is going to be tilted towards the larger cap companies, just because the Vanguard ETFs are cap weighted. But the allocation is just as diverse as you can imagine.
Right, sure. No, but because of the cap weighting. So, I mean, just, you know, looking at the portfolio, you do have some single stock positions that are above 1% here. So not that that's a huge amount of single stock risk, but I wouldn't call it negligible either necessarily.
No, those are going to be the largest holdings. I mean, as far as individual stocks, those are going to be the largest individual stock holdings we have. You're correct.
Cool. All right. Interesting. And then I guess to just kind of take a step back, you know, as we kind of wind things down here. So in the way that you envision this fund, that you envision ARPAR, is it meant to be a core portfolio holding? Is this really a full portfolio in a single fund? Or is it something that you think for many investors is meant to be more of a satellite holding, maybe to smooth out the ride? But let's say take somebody like myself, I'm 40 right now, so I've probably got, you know, solid 25 to 30 good earning years in front of me, and I probably wouldn't want to abandon those really high beta equity exposures entirely. I probably want them in, I mean, probably I do want them in my portfolio also. I want things that have the potential to really kind of go up a ton over a 30-year period given enough time. So how are you envisioning this for investors? And then I guess if you could weigh in just on kind of what the mix between institutions and retail investors has been on the fund and what you're seeing there also.
Sure. I mean, you could think of it in a couple different ways. One is it could be a core holding because it's obviously low cost, tax efficient, liquid, and it has high expected return. So we would think of this ETF as having a equity-like expected return over the long run. So even if your time horizon is 30 years, we would expect that this would perform in line with equities, if not better.
Sorry, just to clarify though, when you say equity-like risk, you're referring to something like the S&P 500 large blend, I assume, not, let's say, the expected returns of something like small cap stocks, right, or value.
Yeah, it's global equities. Okay. So in terms of, so even if the objective is I have 30, you know, a 30-year time horizon, we think for many investors this makes sense because you're not really giving up return over the long run, and you're just taking less risk. And obviously with the tax efficiency, low cost, and liquidity. So you can think of it as a core holding, but a lot of investors think of it as a liquid alternative. It's actually one of the, I think, probably five largest liquid alternative ETFs in the US already. And what a lot of investors do is they slot it next to global tactical asset allocation funds or, you know, these 60-40 type balance funds. And they view this as a a passive, less expensive, more tax efficient, kind of similar type of approach than versus the global tax class allocators, which are more expensive, more active, and less tax efficient. So you can think of them as complementing one another. So either in the alternatives bucket or as a core holding.
That's interesting, and it does make a lot of sense.
The Seeking Alpha Marketplace offers something for every type of investor. Find the investing community that best suits your style, needs, and risk profile. So what are you waiting for? Go to seekingalpha.com/marketplace to learn more.
In terms of the mix between institutions and retail investors, in terms of what you're seeing, do you know what the mix is there on who's actually holding this?
Yeah, we don't have exact numbers because we don't always have full transparency into who owns the ETF. But just from conversations, it seems it's about 50-50 or so. The institutions like it because it's low cost and it's liquid. And then the individuals really appreciate those aspects plus the tax efficiency.
Yeah, definitely. And the fact that there really aren't all that many funds out there like this that you could access as an individual investor. So again, if you don't have that $1 million to, pony up with a hedge fund or something, and you're just building your positions 1 month at a time, squirreling a little bit away, you can get in for no commissions, basically, at this point. Tight spreads and really keep costs down and sleep well at night also with it.
Yeah, and also if you think about what's happened in 2020 thus far, you've had one of the worst bear markets in history in terms of how quickly the market fell 30%+. And then you've had one of the biggest rebounds we've ever seen. And both were completely unexpected. And so something that is kind of gives you passive exposure where you're not trying to time what's going to happen next, low cost, tax efficient, liquid, and is up through that period, can be attractive to a lot of investors, particularly looking forward as far as who knows what the next, forget 6 months, even 6 years looks like. So I think all of that has been resonating with clients. And then also the fact that this is it's not that difficult to understand what this is. You have these exposures to asset classes that are diverse, they do well in different environments, and it's balanced across them. So it's relatively simple to understand. And you can look at history going back 50 plus years and see how these asset classes have done through various environments. And you can see that they kind of zig and zag at different times.
I was going to add that the power of this approach, I think, has been very apparent this year. If I think about the investment climate this year, both on the way down and on the way back up, it's been an incredibly stressful time to manage money. And obviously, when you're losing money, that's very stressful. But what's interesting is I've actually seen this, with advisors we work with advisors that we've talked to. On the way back up, it's been very stressful too, because many people have gotten out of the market at various points in February and March, and they're really struggling around the decision of when to get back in. And as the market has continued to run here, there's been a lot of this fear of missing out. And now there's a concern that maybe it's run too far, too fast. And now it's not a good time to go in. Valuations are terrible. You know, there's a lot of retail speculative activity. And it's just it's very challenging to trade around this. I think this is one of the most difficult environments to trade around that I've experienced in my career. And the beauty of an approach like this is you don't have to make that decision of when to get in and get out. That if you have a balanced asset allocation that has exposure to things that can do well, both on the way down and on the way back up, you're much less dependent on those timing decisions that are nearly impossible to make. And every crisis looks different. And so that's where I think, this has really resonated with a lot of the advisors we've talked to is being able to allocate to something that doesn't have that timing dependency, like a lot of the more equity oriented or growth oriented positions that tend to dominate portfolios.
Sure. Yeah.
The other trend that's emerged is more and more advisors are trimming equities and buying this because they're looking at the equity markets and saying, this makes no sense that equities are up this much, even though unemployment rates are still high and and the virus is still around, and it just, it seems like there's a huge disconnect.
You look at valuations also, you look at, you know, PEs of 30 on the NASDAQ or 27 on the SPX, and you say, how's that possible
right now? Right, how is it possible? And so they're saying, okay, this can't continue. So they're selling equities and buying this because they view it as comparable return with a lot less risk. So that's a trend that we've seen over the last month or so.
Yeah, no, that actually makes a lot of sense. And then I guess we hadn't prepared to discuss this, but before we go, just curious, and no one's going to hold you guys to this, obviously, but curious just for your take on what you do think is going to unfold in the coming months and years in terms of, or have we seen kind of just a straight V-shaped recovery here? Has the Fed and Treasury Department intervened successfully enough, and you know, global central banks acting in lockstep with each other, have they successfully financially engineered the situation here so that it'll just be kind of smooth sailing and stocks will grow back into the valuations that they have right now? Or do you expect a fair amount of pain still to come here?
It's a tough question, but clearly what they've done has worked thus far, right? So you've seen a V-shaped recovery in markets, similar to what you saw in 08. You know, you were heading into the abyss, and then the Fed stepped in and started printing money and cutting rates to zero. And so that's the playbook that they used here, with this time with a lot more force, because the risks in many ways were even greater than they were in 08.
Sure. Although in 08, it should be remembered that there was this really big bear market rally, but markets eventually ended up taking out their old lows in early 2009.
That's right. That's right. And so our best guess is the volatility is going to be around, because there's just so much uncertainty. There's uncertainty in terms of the path of the virus. There's uncertainty in terms of the path of the economy. You know, investor sentiment is very rocky. And the big difference between now and 08 is the Fed is starting to run out of tools. And so they basically threw the kitchen sink in immediately. And you've seen the markets react positively to that. But the real question that remains is, if this, you know, if the economic weakness continues for an extended period of time, how much ammunition do they have left? And so that's the big unknown. And that's, you know, that's what results in this wide range of potential outcomes. And at some point, can you continue printing like you have been? Obviously, you can't really lower rates much more, but the printing of money has limits as well. And as the world's reserve currency, we have a little bit longer leash to do that than some other countries, but it's not endless. So that's where it seems like we're going to be testing the limits of that. And that could lead to a lot of different outcomes that really are unprecedented.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I guess one of the real risks is that they're not really printing. The Treasury has to put every dollar they quote unquote print onto its balance sheet somewhere as debt. So you're ending up in a situation where rates can remain incredibly low for a very, very long period of time, because they simply won't have the ability to raise rates. The second they do that, debt servicing costs for the U.S. government will skyrocket up, as they have to, you know, roll off new bond issues with much higher rates than the ones they currently have on their books the second they hit maturity. And they, you know, you end up with a situation where there's just really, really high debt levels, and I guess potential. I actually think that's probably not all that inflationary, honestly, in the long run.
I mean, debt levels have been rising for 40 years, and interest rates have been falling for 40 years. And I'd say about 10 years ago is when people started talking about rates are so low, they have to start rising. And they've been trending down for 40 years. And if you look across the world, most developed economies are near zero or negative. And the U.S. is actually one of the higher yielding developed world, as among the highest yields. And so the odds that it spikes doesn't seem particularly high. And the Fed has come out and said, we're going to keep rates low for as long as needed. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Anyway, guys, this has been really, really fascinating. Congrats on building a really great fund, RPAR, which has really resonated with ETF investors, both institutional and retail, up until now. I assume the positive inflows will continue, because I think one prediction that I think you made that we can all agree on is that volatility is not going anywhere anytime soon.
Probably right.
So where's the best place for listeners that want to continue researching everything we've been discussing here today to do? Where, just if you could call out some of the sites you have, maybe the ARIS site and also the RPAR ETF site.
Sure. Yeah. The best site for information is rparetf.com. We're constantly updating it with material, educational pieces. There's a fun video that describes the concept. So that's probably the best resource. We also have arisconsulting.com, which is our advisory website. We post interesting research pieces on there, market comments. So between those two, that should provide plenty of reading for interested investors.
Nice. And then are you guys doing the social media thing?
Yeah, we're finalizing a new Twitter account based on popular demand. So that should be online soon.
Yeah, there are, if you can steer clear of politics on Twitter, there's actually amazing conversations that go on around investing, people just posting amazing charts and data points and graphics. And, you know, the second you wade into a political conversation accidentally, it turns into a total cesspool. But financial side of it is actually quite good, I find.
Yeah, and with everything that's happening today, you know, we're kind of living through one of the most important points in history in terms of financial markets. There's never a shortage of interesting things to talk about.
No question about it. All right, anyway, best of luck, guys. Hope you're staying safe and sane as we weather this crazy COVID-19 pandemic together globally. Best of luck out there. Hope we can do it again sometime.
We appreciate it. Thank you,
Jonathan.
For disclosures, both Alex Shahidi and Damien Bisserier are long RPAR. I am long BAR.
If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.